I'll be talking today a little bit about one of the possible philosophical implications of thinking about how, because if you ask a philosophy question, it's impossible to give you a straight answer. So, but before we get going, I thought I'd ask if I can ask you to think about the following scenario. I'd like you to imagine that you've just hired a new colleague, and on the first day of their contract, they come into your office and tell you that they're really looking forward to teaching, but they, of course, because of their ideological commitments, cannot teach members of X group, where X group is some vulnerable group in society, or member of a liberation group, or an other group. Doesn't really matter which, but they say that they can't teach them because they believe either that the people in that group shouldn't have access to higher education, or shouldn't be taught alongside members of other groups within society. If you can be thinking about while we go on, I think that we'd probably all have a bit of a concern if that was raised with us, to put it subtly. And I think we'd also probably have a bit more of a concern if the university said, oh yes, of course, well, we have to respect this person's right to conscientiously object to teaching these people. But what we'll do is we'll rearrange the timetable so that they don't have students of that group in their classes. And that those students will be redistributed to everyone else in the department, and the students will never know that this is what's happened. They'll just happen. They might notice that certain classes lack certain kinds of diversity. They might notice that they never get taught by an X professor, but they're never going to know that this is because of the particular commitments of this particular member of faculty. If you can be thinking about that while I waffle on, that would be grand, because we're going to come back to it at the end. So, thinking about this question, there's a couple of different ways we can think about how, and I'll come to that in a moment, but the way I interpreted that is what conditions need to obtain and what do we need to do in order for conscientious objection to be ethical, moral, and just in healthcare provision. That's possibly a bit more of an expansive question, but again, philosopher, sorry, can't help it. We can think of that in a couple of different ways. We can think of that in terms of the practice and the individual care procedure and practice of specific healthcare providers. We can think of it in terms of what an individual medic or physician or pharmacist or nurse or whoever interacts with a specific patient. We can think of it as what they do in any given situation so to ensure that their patients receive adequate care. We can also think of it in terms of law and policy, in terms of how we legislate, which we heard about a moment ago, and what we should be doing in order to respect the fundamental equality of all members of society. And then we can also think about it in terms of sort of which is slightly broader than the particular practice questions, which tend to be very narrow and focused on individual interactions or categories of interaction. Or we can think in terms of the broadest possible underlying features, which are the background conditions of justice or principles of justice within society as a whole or generally speaking. So those we can think of as, I think, the broadest possible things. We have to make it narrower as we get towards individual patients, because we can't create principles of justice that are going to apply to every single context. Or we can, but through filtering it through the law, we can't legislate for every individual context. So we need to sort of think about these things as tiered in a way, having very distinct requirements. So something that might occur to us at the level of policy or at the level of theory isn't necessarily going to apply directly, or will have to be filtered through the practice of what we can require people to actually do. At the same time, we can think of these things as being very, very specific when it comes to theory, but also broadening out as we come to the number of ways in which theory can be applied to policy and the very, very wide range of contexts in which conscientious objections might apply. So there are far more areas of specific conscientious objections and doctor-patient interactions than there are necessarily philosophical principles that apply to them. So we can have a general overview which relates to a much wider range of contexts. So what I'll be looking at is the sort of the bottom tier of that pyramid, whichever way around we look at it. And I think it's useful when we think about these things to think about why we think it's important to have rights of conscientious objection. And we typically think, I think it's reasonable to suggest that there are two kinds of categories. The first relate to sort of the individual and how that it's important for individuals to have a right to freedom of conscience. It's important for personal autonomy and freedom. we think it preserves, so we think it's a way of preserving the rights of individuals to live lives that they think are good, that it's harmful in some way to be told, to be forced to comply with moral principles that we don't personally endorse, though within reason. And then we can think of the way that rights to conscientious objections and freedom of conscience protect people from the power of the state. So it's kind of a final barrier or a default protection against the power of the state to coerce. So if we have rights to conscientiously object to some things, the state, which have to be guaranteed, the state can't force us to do things which we believe to be wrong, because being forced to do those things is seen as inherently harmful in some specifically important kind of way. It's also, at the level of theory, it's a fundamental commitment of liberal pluralist states. It seems to be a way of allowing us to muddle along when we disagree with one another and protect us in those important ways that I mentioned. And it's a constraint on the power of the state to enforce those moral codes with which we might have disagreements. And in doing so, it enables philosophical and moral and religious diversity of perspective within those states. So it's a fundamental commitment of what we think of as liberal democratic pluralist states. And with this in mind, as we've heard, there's various different pieces of legislation. So the GMC has these requirements, and as we've seen in law, have to explain to objection to patients, have to make sure that there's must inform patients of available care, of appropriate care, must refer to alternative sources of provision, can't obstruct care, can't leave patients with nowhere to turn. So in emergencies or where there's specific time relative need. And it must be respectful of patients' dignity and their views. So we have these sort of commitments which recognise that conscientious objection isn't the only thing. It is very important. It's fundamental to certain kinds of important welfare concern. But we're also aware of the impact on other providers, what the cost will be for medical colleagues. The Daily Mail test, as we think of, is how do we make sure that there isn't going to be a patient who might go to a newspaper and complain, and there is a recognition that it's important to protect the reputation of the health service and the welfare of colleagues. There's also recognition that there are rights to care. In certain kinds of cases which come up with conscientious a lot, such as contraception and abortion, rights to particular broader concerns such as reproductive autonomy and bodily integrity. There's also a concern about welfare of patients, and of course the sort of general rights to freedom of conscience within society as a whole. So this is a thing that, and the commitment to pluralism and state neutrality. So we allow conscientious objection to allow healthcare providers to have these rights, but also we have to recognise that how they affect patients and other providers is relevant as well. Dan Brock, as I'm sure many of you are aware, has sort of summarised this position as being sort of summarising and collated these to what he calls the conventional compromise. And what this does, it sort of collates a lot of the arguments and says these are the things that might be relevant, that are most important, and if they are fulfilled, then conscientious objection is legitimate and should be justified in this. But the three conditions are: providers must inform, so you can't conceal information; they must refer, so you can't abandon patients. And the referrals can't impose an unreasonable burden on patients. So you can't abandon patients. It's the general idea, and patients must be aware of what's available to them and must have reasonable access to it. I'd like to add a couple of utopian and unrealistic and counterfactual conditions to that, because, again, philosopher, sorry. And what I'd like to suggest is that these referrals don't impose costs on non-client third parties. So that's not the patient, that's not the person in the pharmacy, that's other physicians, other pharmacists, other people working in the health service. So this is mentioned already, but I'd like to specify that that doesn't impose any costs on other healthcare professions or on society as a whole. So no material costs. And then the final one is perhaps more important, is that objection providers are going to lie. They'll lie to their clients as to why they cannot provide a service. So they don't have the ability. And I'm sure all the hackles about honesty are going to come up in a moment, but there's a very good reason for that, which will come to in a moment. So the reason I think that that's important to have that condition is to draw out one of these things that we might not otherwise notice in this discussion about conscientious objection. If providers lie, there's no risk If they say, I'm terribly sorry, I can't provide it, I'm not qualified, I'm too busy, my colleague is better at that, they've got more experience, or whatever it is, there's no risk that there's any kind of implicit judgment of moral sort of failure for wanting a service. So there's no statement of you. I don't think that's wrong. There's no implied judgment that because I think it's wrong, I'm in a position of social power or social authority, you are a bad person for doing it, which can be implied in certain kinds of circumstances. So there's a way of avoiding any what we might think of as a dignitary harm in the particular instance. So, and I recognise that these are unrealistic. But with this, with these conditions in place, we might think that we get sort of the ideal outcomes of what we want. We get this concessions made by both parties. Clients will allow providers to have the space to live according to their own form of the view of the good. There aren't any serious barriers to access. People can get access to the goods if they have entitlements. There's no reputational damage to the health service or dignitary harm to the patients in that particular instance. We're not going to find patients who go, I went to my doctor for a given service and they told me I was a bad person for wanting it, and therefore this has left me with a negative image of the health service as a whole. So there's no kind of, and they weren't judged or criticised for wanting a service which the objecting provider has an issue with. And so we seem to be in a situation where people get their relevant rights fulfilled, they get their health needs respected, and we avoid the Isaiah Berlin's pike problem, which is the freeway, the pike is death for the minnows, hence the big scary fish on the slide. We seem to have a situation that seems that we get everything that we might think is relevant or important. However, we need to think that we've put ourselves in a position where there are no material deprivations of stipulated. But we don't allow conscientious objections in all cases, as we've heard. We don't allow, there are lots of different situations just within healthcare where it's not permitted. I don't think that we necessarily should allow conscientious objections in all circumstances. AL and Ghostries describe it as the anarchy problem. We end up with, well, I'm going to object to that. So if everyone is doing that all the time, we find it virtually impossible to deliver basic services. We find it makes it very, very difficult to really have much of a society as a whole. So as a result, we can think that we do have responsibility to actively cooperate with things that we disagree with, or the things that we object. If you're a Republican, you don't get to opt out of paying the taxes which support the monarchy, much as I regret that. If you're a pacifist, you don't get to you don't have to fight in a war if you conscientiously object, but you may have to work in a factory or contribute taxes which support the arms industry and the military. There are certain kinds of things with which we have to actively cooperate if we're going to avoid that anarchy problem that's been mentioned. So as a result, freedom of conscience isn't absolute. No more than we have an absolute right to freedom of speech and yell fire in a crowded theatre, cliched as that example is, we can't have a right to absolute freedom of conscience, or else we end up with Berlin's problem again. So this is, as I say, if you're a pacifist, you have to cooperate in some way with certain kinds of military commitments. It might be quite distant, but you do have to participate. As a result, when a state says that you can conscientiously object, it's saying it's within the realm of reasonable liberal discourse and it's compatible with the commitments of pluralism and egalitarianism and liberalism that states are committed to. So if we're allowing a conscientious objection within that context, we're saying the principles on which it's grounded are fundamentally compatible with what we as a whole think. So it's not beyond the pale, it's not fundamentally anti-egalitarian. It's possibly morally neutral. Though such commitments can be possibly morally neutral, but they might also be reinforcing of harmful social narratives or fundamentally inegalitarian. So we might endorse, as within those principles, certain things that make statements about certain groups in society. And so hopefully that image of the legislator might be coming up. Now, Julian Sabaleska uses the example of the fair innings argument. It's possible to consistently and coherently hold that people of a certain ages have had a fair innings, so they've had their fair amount of healthcare provision, it's possible for a physician to argue that as a result they're not going to provide treatment to people over the age of Y. I don't happen to agree with that claim. I believe it's coherent, that it is possible to coherently believe it. I believe that it's wrong. But we don't allow people to conscientiously object to that provision, and in fact we explicitly say it would be illegal to do so in the Equalities Act, but someone could consistently and coherently believe it, just as consistently and coherently as someone who believed that, for example, abortion was wrong. But we prohibit one and not the other. The consequences of that is it's saying that the belief in the impermissibility of certain things is compatible, but that one isn't. So we have this situation where we find ourselves where we're implicitly endorsing the commitments, the philosophical commitments that underpin certain kinds of conscientious objections as compatible with liberal pluralism, and others when they don't. To come back to education, that isn't a purely theoretical case. That isn't entirely a thought example. This is a photo taken from the Obama White House's Flickr account. It's taken from the museum that commemorates the Brown v. Board of Education decision that desegregated American schools. And fundamental to that case was the claim that it didn't matter how good the alternative provision was, it was fundamentally incompatible with egalitarianism, with this commitment to the state, to have any kind of separation between African-American and Caucasian children. It was fundamentally unjust to have other provision, and that was inherently harmful to those students. Separate is not equal is the sort of the one sentence description of the case. So we find ourselves, if we're going to allow conscientious objection, we can't find ourselves in a situation where we think that we've solved all the problems of inegalitarianism and discrimination simply by allowing alternative provision, because we've seen that this is recognised as sometimes being fundamentally incompatible with the commitments of liberal democratic states and fundamentally incompatible with egalitarianism. It doesn't matter how good the alternative provision is if it's making a statement that, oh well, your rights to this service is contingent upon other people allowing you to have it, and you have to then go somewhere else to get it from you. So this is particularly important in cases such as abortion and contraception, because it's fundamentally important to reproductive autonomy and bodily integrity, and therefore recognition as a morally equal citizen within a liberal democratic state. So I said I was going to talk about how, and in a roundabout way I think I sort of have, but if we're going to think about how, we want to get a ethical, moral, just, conscientious objection in healthcare provision. We need to think about how it's actually going to affect this commitment to neutrality. Not just neutrality, but active neutrality amongst incompatible moral perspectives. We need to think about, so material deprivation is important. We can't allow material deprivation, but it's not the only thing that's relevant. We have to think about what's happening when a state says we will carve out space in the legal and professional commitments of a particular profession in order to allow and protect freedom of conscience and conscientious objection, and what it says to the people who rely on the service around which the conscientious objection is centred. So what is happening when a state says it is okay for you to opt out of this professional and legal duty, and what is it saying about the person who relied on that objective? So as I've said, separate doesn't mean it's not equal. And so we have to make sure that those dignitary harms that I mentioned at the beginning are absent and are prevented, not just in the individual interactions at the top of that pyramid, but also at the level of policy in the middle and at the level of theory at the bottom. So we have to make sure that those dignitary harms are not present in any stage of that pyramid. And we have to, I think, and this is the point that I'm not least sure on, but I'm not sure how we achieve it. We have to have active restorative justice. So it can't be the case that, oh, we fixed it now. We have to think about the wider context which might make certain people particularly vulnerable to these kinds of theoretical, policy, legal, dignitary harms, even if they are hidden from the individual instances. Thank you very much.